On this episode of Skeptico, Christian author and lecturer Rusty Wright on the limits of scientific research into the near-death experience.
My perspective would be, I say, let's welcome science, but recognize its limits. You know, it's very important to follow science, but it's important to recognize that different methods are appropriate for answering different types of questions.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris. If you recall in the last episode of Skeptico, I took a minute at the beginning to talk about what constitutes evidence for some of the claims made by some of our guests. Well, that generated quite a bit of interesting discussion, both on our forums and in the emails that I received from you. So I thought that I'd kind of take that to another level. You know, last time I pointed out how skeptics can often sound open-minded and sound like they're interested in evidence and then really fail to follow through and demonstrate that they really are either open-minded or really interested in examining evidence in a real substantive way. You've also heard on this show many folks who've been in the front lines of controversial research talk about how they really see no difference between fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist skeptics who are wrapped up in scientism as a way of validating their beliefs. So I thought on this episode, we'd kind of look at the other side of that. And I thought it'd be interesting and very appropriate to talk to someone who is a fundamentalist Christian, conservative Christian, and explore how they deal with the evidence and how open-minded they are, or at least appear to be. You know, now this is not a show about proving or disproving Christianity or the Bible or anything like that. I think that is quite convincingly done in other places. If anyone's interested, I would point you to Googling the Jesus Seminar, and I think you'll, if you haven't already explored that information, I think you'll find it really, really interesting and very good example of how difficult it is to sift through the evidence, especially in areas that are controversial. And certainly, there's probably nothing more controversial in our society than Christianity. Now, I have to admit that when I started Skeptico, I was a bit naive to just how much the power of this cognitive dissidence, this inability to overcome your belief system and step outside of it and really look at evidence that might contradict what you hold near and dear as being true, how powerful that is, how hard that is to change. But I think as the evolution of this show will demonstrate, I've learned that, or I'm coming to understand that. And I don't think that's the end of the story. I think there's a lot of intelligent people on both sides of these debates that are struggling to overcome their bias, their cognitive dissidence, and find a middle ground and learn from each other. And that's certainly what this show is all about. So next, my interview with Rusty Wright. Joined today by an award-winning author, journalist, and lecturer who is going to give us a very interesting perspective on the near-death experience, I'm hoping, a Christian perspective, which is something new that we haven't had on our show so far. He's a graduate of Duke University and also received master's degrees from Duke as well as Oxford. Rusty Wright, welcome to Skeptico.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's great to be here with you.
Well, I really appreciate you joining me, and as we were just chatting about, we've had a very nice email exchange, and you've really gone above and beyond the call of responding to some of the articles that I sent you and really digging into this, so I'm looking forward to having a really great dialogue with you today.
Oh, good. I've enjoyed getting into it, yeah.
Good. Well, thanks a lot. You know where I thought we might start, because we do deal with things really from a scientific basis rather than usually from a spiritual basis, although we have had several folks on who are from a spiritual tradition. We had Rabbi Rami Shapiro, and we had on just recently, it hasn't aired yet, but B. Allen Wallace, who's from the Buddhist tradition. So I think it's really wonderful for you to agree to come on to the show. And where I thought you might start is maybe tell us a little bit about your background, and particularly what sent you down the path that where you are now. I know you work at probe.org in the Probe Ministries. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your path to where, how you've come to where you are.
Yes, very definitely. And especially as I talk a little bit about this, some interesting things along the way sort of piqued my interest in the near-death experience, life after death issues, things like that. I grew up in Miami and had an interest in spiritual things as a child, was raised in the Presbyterian Church, but then went away to boarding school in Connecticut and did very well in sports and academics and student government and so forth, but then went to the opposite extreme and almost got expelled from school for some problems I got into. So I kind of put religion on the shelf at that point. I was actually sort of mad at God and kind of blaming him for some of my own bad choices in retrospect, but I remember the summer before my freshman year at Duke, I decided I wanted to try to figure out this question about the afterlife. Did it exist, and how could I experience it and all that? And so I tried to do some studying on it and thinking, but then the more I did, the more I guess my stomach would be in knots. I didn't really have a good answer for it, and so I just kind of put it aside and probably was frightened, I guess, because I didn't have a good answer for that. So as a Duke freshman, a guy called me up during freshman orientation week and invited me to a Christian meeting. He had met a friend of mine at a conference in California. And I was skeptical, but I went and immediately became attracted to the students they had there. I'd been to an all-boys boarding school, and so there were very attractive young women there. And this was kind of a mixed motive, I guess. I began to hang around these folks. I was interested in what they said about God, but I didn't believe it all, and I was probably more interested in that it was a good place to get a date. But the more I spent time around them, I saw how their faith affected their lives and relationships, and they told me the biblical message that God loved me, but that I was separated from him by a condition of alienation, and that the biblical God had sent Jesus to die and rise again so that I could be forgiven. And the more I investigated, the more it made sense. And so finally, through an attitude of my heart, I did ask Christ to enter my life and forgive me. And there was no thunder and lightning or angels. And, you know, I certainly didn't become perfect overnight or didn't become perfect at all. But I found a peace of mind that I'd not had, and I found a freedom from guilt. I saw my self-image improve and saw these changes take place in my life. Well, it had a very positive impact on me, and also about that time I began to look at some of the evidences, because I was very skeptical. I didn't want to believe something just because others had taught it to me or, you know, the church said it was true. And so I began to look at evidences, especially for the historical resurrection of Jesus, and that's really what convinced me that the whole thing was true when I saw that there was a solid case for that. But then there were also some death and psychology-related experiences that got me interested in what I'm doing now. The spring of my sophomore year, the guy in our fraternity house, the guy that lived in the room next to me, was struck and killed by lightning. He was playing golf one afternoon in the springtime, and the thunderstorm came up. He went under a tree for shelter, and he was killed instantly by lightning. And our house was just in a state of shock. I mean, you can imagine, it, especially if you're on a campus. It was a little bit like, you know, Virginia Tech, the recent, of course, that was a massacre caused by an individual, but when the students were in a state of shock there, and we were in a state of shock. I mean, this was very minor compared to what happened at Virginia Tech, but that type of feeling and anguish, you know, wondering what is life all about, is there life after death, how can we experience it, and there were lots of late night sessions, you know, guys trying to sort this out. Well, I was a psychology major, and my junior year I took a course in abnormal psych, and I wrote a paper for the course investigating a biblical therapy for anxiety, and one of the causes of anxiety I dealt with was fear and fear of death. And I sent a copy of it to the author of our textbook, James Coleman, a prominent psychologist at UCLA, and he surprised me by writing back and saying he liked it and he was going to read it to his grad students. And asked if he could quote from it in his textbook. Well, I was flabbergasted, you know, in junior college. So the first thing I did was photocopy his letter and send it home to my folks in Miami so they'd know their son hadn't totally gone off the deep end with this campus, you know, spiritual involvement. But long story short, I had a chance to meet Dr. Coleman that summer at his home in Malibu and explain to him how I had come to faith a few years before that, and he decided that he wanted to make the same decision to place his faith in Christ, and so he did that. And the next edition of his textbook contained a short portion about religion and psychotherapy, and it had part of my spiritual journey in it. So I began to go to psych profs and tell them I was a case in their abnormal psychology textbook, and they, you know, they were interested and, you know, would invite me to speak in their classes. So that's one of the ways I got involved in all this, in speaking. And then especially the near-death experience in the mid-70s when Raymond Moody's Life After Life came out. I actually read it, an excerpt in Reader's Digest that a family member gave me shortly before the book was released, I think. And that got me fascinated with what do these experiences mean? You know, are they positive? Are they negative? How do they jibe with the biblical perspective of God and heaven and hell and all that sort of stuff? So I wrote a book on it, investigating people who'd had these experiences. Found out that my mother actually had one, and I began to put the word out, you know, to find people that I could interview, and it was really quite fascinating. So that's a short encapsulation of how I got to this point of in my spiritual journey and also in the interest in near-death experiences.
Well, great. Now, it's very interesting. And I think that, you know, as I say, we've really focused on science on this podcast because of the power that science gives us to kind of investigate. But I think that in the process of doing that, sometimes we do have a tendency to kind of be a little bit dismissive of the personal stories that people have and the personal transformations that people go through. And I certainly don't want to do that because I think that's very important. And to all of us, to each of us, our own personal journey has the most meaning. And I think that if science is to be faulted in some respects, is that it sometimes goes off the deep end and doesn't come back and touch us personally with the things that really matter for us. But maybe that's getting off the subject, because I really wanted to come back to science, because what I thought would be interesting to discuss with you, coming from a very strong spiritual perspective and from a very strong spiritual tradition, the Christian tradition, I wanted to talk about how we can, or how you resolve your beliefs and your spirituality with advances in science. And the reason I've focused on the near-death experience is not for any personal reason, but more because I'm interested in understanding human consciousness. And I have to tell you, maybe you said you've listened to a couple of podcasts. I feel like I'm usually on the other side of this debate or this discussion than I am with you. I feel like a lot of times I'm confronting people who have kind of an atheistic worldview, really, that is a materialistic worldview, and they're very, very resistant to hearing any new information, any new data that challenges their existing paradigm. Even if we're not replacing it with another paradigm and saying, even if I'm not saying this means Jesus or this means Allah or anything, they don't want to hear any of it because it so undermines any idea they have about how the world should work. Of course, those folks would have the same criticism of Christian fundamentalists that they encounter, that they can never present any data in a scientific way that would ever give them pause to kind of reconsider their beliefs. So I thought that's a long, long way of asking a very short question. And the question is, how do you resolve your faith with what's being discovered in science, in whatever area of science that is?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I really appreciate you raising it, because although I'm not a scientist, I've had great interest in science. My undergraduate degree is in psychology. It's a Bachelor of Science in Psychology, because I did study a certain amount of science before my interest changed more to the social sciences. And I tend to be a very skeptical person, too. I ask lots of questions, and as I was approaching matters of faith, my perspective was my will would not want to follow, what my mind could not accept, or at least, you know, have a basic understanding of. And I think it's very important to consider science and what science is finding out in this case, like about the NDEs, and for instance, especially the fascinating concept of, you know, can we demonstrate that consciousness continues to exist when the brain stops? And that's what the Kellys, Ed and Emily Kelly, were talking about, and some of the things that they've studied at the University of Virginia. And I mentioned to you, through an odd coincidence, Emily Williams Kelly and I were actually at Duke at the same time. We were classmates in the early 70s. And then Raymond Moody, as I was listening to your recent interview with him, I thought he made an excellent point when he said, of course, he's a scientist, but he said, sometimes we misinform the public about the scientific method, and we feel that the experimental method of science, for instance, is the only way to determine truth. And Moody went on to say, you know, if we do that, we're excluding history, philosophy, literature. And he even went into an interesting concept. I can't remember the word he used, but he talked about narration. It was like narrative, or, you know, the importance of understanding people's stories. What was the word he used? Do you remember?
Well, I think, as I remember it, and I think I remember it the way you did too, is that he said to really understand the near-death experience, we have to look at it, and I guess I'm forgetting the word too, but from the perspective of a narrative and study it. Yes, there is some word for that, and it's escaping me too. Yes.
Right, okay. Well, anyway, the point I was getting at is that I thought Raymond did a good job of stating as a scientist that we need to value science but recognize its limitations. And I think way too many religious people feel threatened by science, and they're closed-minded and they don't want to have, you know, anything to do with what modern science is doing. My perspective would be, I say, let's welcome science but recognize its limits. And here's the illustration I would give. I think it's important to distinguish between the experimental method of science and what I would call another method of determining truth, the legal or historical method. The experimental method of science is based on repeatability. Simple illustration, I like M&M's candies, and M&M's used to advertise saying M&M's melt in your mouth, not in your hands. If you wanted to prove that that's true using the experimental method of science, you get 100 people, let's say 100 M&M's, put an M&M in there, have everybody hold one in their hand for 2 minutes and then in their mouth for 2 minutes, and then, you know, see whether it melted in the mouth or in the hands. Now, that is repeatable, it's controllable, and it's observable by an objective outsider. And if you find that in most cases it melted in the mouth, not in the hands, then you can draw that conclusion. The experimental method is valid with issues and situations that can be repeated, but it has limits with situations that can't be repeated, like in matters of history. We could not use the experimental method of science to prove that George Washington was the first U.S. president, or that you went to the grocery store this morning, because they're not events that we can repeat with everything being the same, including the time. Instead, we would evaluate evidence and attempt to show certainty beyond a reasonable doubt, just like an attorney might in a criminal law case. And so I say, you know, it's very important to follow science, but it's important to recognize that different methods are appropriate for answering different types of questions.
I don't think you'd get any debate on that issue. I think that where the issue comes in is that if that's going to be used as an excuse or a way to kind of ignore or dismiss science that we don't like, and I think both sides do that. So, you know, as you point out, there's different ways of applying the experimental method, and I think science has been revolutionized in the last 100 years. The scientific method has changed and refined, and we're using different methods of exploring social sciences as opposed to hard sciences, if you will. The methods are always changing, but are we moving, and can we move towards a truth? And what happens when that truth conflicts with a cherished, held, a dogmatic belief that's held by a religion? Let me switch the focus off of me for a minute, and you know, I like to play clips of past guests and get some real experts on here rather than just me talking. And I think this topic that we've been talking about is addressed quite directly by a gentleman we had on, Dr. Neil Grossman, who is a professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And I've sent you this clip, but let me play it for the rest of our audience. And then if we could, I'd like to get you to respond, because I think it's exactly what we're talking about.
Both the extreme materialists, right, the scientistic type, and the devout religious person have something in common. And what they have in common is that belief in a spiritual reality is a matter of faith. To the religious person, the idea, that the very idea that some of their beliefs might be capable of being investigated by science to determine whether they're true or false, that seems to be threatening. What comes out of the near-death experience, what people report, they review their lives and there are judgments, but they themselves are making the judgments. What they report coming from God is only unconditional love. Well, if you take that and look at religion in America and how many denominations are fear-based, that is deeply threatened by near-death experience research, because the concept of God and the afterlife and how it works is very, very different from what they want to believe.
Rusty, were you able to hear that okay?
Yes, I sure could. I agree with him that many religions, especially in this country, are fear-based. And frankly, I wish that some of my Christian colleagues would emphasize the love of God more than they do. And I agree also that it's very easy for Christians as well as scientists, anybody, to react when one's cherished beliefs are challenged, just like you said that you found when you encounter people who are hardcore materialists and, you know, they just don't seem to want to look at the possibility that there could be survival of consciousness, that sort of thing. The question I had about Dr. Grossman's statement about the NDE reports emphasizing, you know, basically only displaying a God of unconditional love is that frankly, a lot of the reports have varied. Raymond Moody, when Life After Life first came out, basically said that he had, only encountered the positive experiences and hadn't run into anything that looked like heaven or hell or anything like that. But then as he continued to investigate, he did find experiences that one could describe as heavenly and also some that would seem more on the hellish side. And he came out, of course, he's written many books, but his subsequent book to Life After Life was Reflections on Life After Life, came out a few years later. And he talks about a woman, let me see if I can glance at this here. Yeah, one of the negative experiences, for instance, a woman who was thought to be dead for 15 minutes described some bewildered spirit she saw. She said, what you would think of as their head was bent downward. They had sad, depressed looks. They seemed to shuffle as someone would on a chain gang. They all had the most woebegone expressions. It was quite depressing, that type of thing. And one of the fascinating accounts to me was around this time, too, Maurice Rawlings, a Chattanooga cardiologist, began to talk about experiencers that he had had contact with. Is that name familiar to you, or have you run into his?
No, I haven't, but please continue.
Yes. Rawlings I think he's retired now. He was a cardiologist in Chattanooga. And one day he had a patient who was on the treadmill in the doctor's office having some routine tests. And the patient had a heart attack, cardiac arrest. And so Rawlings, the cardiologist, is administering CPR and trying to help the guy. And the patient fades in and out of consciousness and unconsciousness, clinical life and clinical death. And occasionally Dr. Rawlings had to stop what he was doing and go do something else, adjust some instruments or something with his hands. And he said, on those occasions when the patient was conscious and the doctor was not performing CPR, the patient had this horrified look on his face, and he said, "Don't stop, Doc. I'm in hell." Well, that, you know, got Dr. Rawlings' interest in this, so he began to study more about these and found a number of the quote-unquote hellish types of experiences. But the interesting thing he found, though, Alex, was that he said he went to this patient like I think it was a couple days later, and talked to him in the hospital room, and the patient had absolutely no recollection of the hellish experience. It was like he had repressed it. And Dr. Rawlings found this a lot of times, that patients that would describe hellish experiences during the episode itself would not remember at all a few days later. And the theory he came up with is that perhaps these patients were repressing these negative experiences because they were so unpleasant, or they didn't want to believe that if there really was a heaven and a hell, that they were, you know, had a taste of the, you know, the negative, that type of thing. And he says that a lot of the accounts we get of near-death experiences come from stories that have been told to psychologists, psychiatrists, and journalists who are interviewing people after the fact, even as short a time period as a couple of days after the fact, they could have repressed it. And so he feels, and said that he felt that's one reason why there weren't more negative types of experiences that were, we'd read in the popular and scientific press.
Well, I think this, to me, relates back to a couple of points we were talking about before in terms of how one would go about investigating this. And I don't, again, want to dismiss the personal experiences and accounts of people that have these near-death experiences, because I think they're fascinating, I think they're rich, and I don't think they should be easily dismissed. At the same time, if I look at it from a scientific perspective, I say, wow, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. There's a whole huge, huge area to be explored here in terms of consciousness if we cross over the chasm and say we do have a dualistic nature to this mind-body thing that's going on. So I'm less, personally, less willing to get too excited about the individual accounts. But I think it does kind of point to a larger question. And I guess I'd bring it back maybe to this issue of Christianity. What happens if we examine the near-death experience scientifically, not with these accounts, but in other ways that we've done it, and we find that, for instance, there isn't any, we cannot trace it back to there being any difference between, let's say, Christians and Hindus, or Christians and Muslims, or Christians and anyone else. Are we then, can we, at what point can we say this is starting to call into question any one particular religion's kind of stranglehold on the truth?
Well, I think the best way I could respond to that would be to present briefly the grid through which I interpret the near-death experiences, or OBEs. I think that some can be caused physiologically, some pharmacologically, some psychologically, and some spiritually. Physiological explanations, if a person has a blow on the head or experiences cerebral anoxia, lack of oxygen in the brain from a heart attack, for instance, those can cause mental images. I'm not saying that causes all of them. I'm saying that's one possible category. Another would be pharmacological, drug-related, through an anesthetic. Ketamine is an anesthetic that's administered intravenously and has some effects that are similar to some of the near-death experiences. Not all, but some. Psychologically, some would say maybe the patient is simply experiencing wish fulfillment. You know, they don't want to believe that everything's going to end, and so in their mind they create this concept of survival. And other psychologists would say that maybe the reports we get from the patients are only the patient interpreting whatever they had. They have a flash of light and some experience, and they, you know, need some, like Charles Tart at UC Davis talked about this, that people need some way to interpret the experience in terms and concepts they're familiar with. So they may say they saw Jesus or God or, you know, some deity from their culture, whatever that might be. And then the spiritual explanations, that it could be a genuine spiritual experience, I would say, but it could be caused by a benevolent God, or Jesus, of course, was very clear in his teaching that there is a spiritual being who is evil, and he called him Satan, and it said that Satan is, he said he's a liar and the father of lies, and he also said that he disguises himself as an angel of light. Now, I want to you know, clarify when I say that. I mean, you know, as soon as I bring up something like Satan, it's very easy for people to think, well, it's just totally gone off the deep end here. You know, how can you expect us to believe this? And I felt that way for many years, too. I mean, you know, Duke, the university I attended, their mascot was the Blue Devil, and Satan for me was, you know, some guy that ran around at basketball games with a devil costume and a pitchfork. And then I heard a Christian speaker once say that the biblical Satan is a deceiver, and he's got some people so deceived that they don't even believe he exists. And that did not prove for me that the demonic world existed, but it really got me thinking, because I thought, well, maybe, you know, I could be in that category of just not believing he exists because I've been deceived. And Jesus was very clear about that. So I figured if I'm going to be open-minded, I have to allow for both good and bad in the spiritual area. And if someone comes up with an experience where they say that they saw some God that seems to differ from the biblical God, I would have to put it through this grid of asking questions. Could it be physiologically based, the experience that they're relating? Could it be pharmacological? Could it be psychological? Could it be spiritual, either from, you know, benevolent or malevolent? And so there's a lot that goes into it. It's not, I don't claim to be able to interpret every given one, but looking at a grid like that, I'd want to put the specific report, you know, through that and see how I could, you know, what conclusion I would come up with.
Okay, but I think just to kind of refine that a little bit, let's do a little thought experiment. Because first of all, the first part of what you're talking about is being done right now. And as you know from a couple of the studies that I sent you, in particular, the study that's published in The Lancet by a cardiologist named Von Lommel, and he studied people right after they had a cardiac arrest. And they looked for exactly those things. Is there a psychological explanation? Fear of death? And again, there's pretty standard psychological methods we can do that. We can survey the people beforehand and determine which ones are experiencing that and which ones aren't. It's not perfect, but it's a pretty well-proven way of kind of ferreting out those beliefs and values that people have and how they change. We can also easily draw blood, as they have from these folks, and see if there's an explanation that's pharmacological and if they have certain chemicals or even certain hormones that are released in the blood at a time. So they eliminate those out. And they have. I mean, that's the data. So what we're really left with is, one, a materialistic explanation, which is, oh, this is the last gasp of a dying brain. The brain is shutting down. Of course, that doesn't fit with anything else we know about how brains work, and that if a brain is shutting down, it wouldn't be having the most complex neurological functioning that would be required to have this really, really elaborate, transformative kind of experience. So let's say we've pared it down on your grid to those experiences. And then I guess I'd relate back to something that we were talking about earlier. You know, me as a layperson, as a non-Christian, as someone who was brought up in the Greek Orthodox tradition and has decided that seems more like mythology to me than anything else. And I look at it just from, how am I going to figure things out? How am I going to know? I go back to one of the things that you said when you were at Duke and you go to the party and you think, hey, maybe there's some attractive women here. And then you're drawn to these people, and these people become the light that draws you and the way that they're leading their lives. I think that's a very interesting aspect to look at from the near-death experience. If we look at folks and we look at the transformative aspect of their life, and again, that's something that is valid to measure in a scientific way. Psychologists do this kind of thing all the time. Well, there's some really interesting data that emerges there inside this grid, inside these people that we have no other way of accounting for how they had this experience. And then we say this experience has transformed them, and in every way it's transformed them for the good. Now are we getting closer to an experience that both you, that would give you as a Christian pause to say, wait, Maybe there's something here. Could it ever give you pause? Could it ever say, gee, maybe God isn't just this one definition that I have of Christianity? Maybe some other people you've heard this voice all the time, right? There's all sorts of people who say there's not just one God. I mean, it's very pop culture kind of thing. That's a different religious paradigm. What kind of evidence would give you pause to say, hey, maybe there is this, maybe my paradigm isn't completely correct.
Well, I want to be open-minded and consider lots of different viewpoints. And I frankly really try to do that. I mean, I grew up in Miami. The Jewish population of Miami has been larger than many cities of Israel. And as a kid in grade school, we were taught Hanukkah songs as well as Christmas songs. You know, we learned those. I'm going to Jordan this November and hope to do some interviews with some leaders there who try to talk about a lot of the similarities between Islam and Christianity and Judaism. King Abdullah of Jordan gave a speech at the National Prayer Breakfast a couple of years ago that I thought was quite fascinating about that. And so I really do want to do everything I can to learn about other religions. The issue of what would it take to convince me that, I think what you're getting at is, what would it take to convince me that my concept of the deity, the biblical God, Jesus and all that, is not true, that maybe, you know, it's really Muhammad or maybe it's pantheism? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, and let me put it.
What would it take to falsify that?
And not just falsify it, because it again comes down to this wonderful, wonderful gift that we've been given called science and the scientific method. And the problem that I see, what really kind of gets me riled, is when I see people on either side of this debate that acknowledge the gaps, but then want to fill in the gaps with something that they are assuming that it's true, rather than saying, you know, you said you listened to the Dr. Raymond Moody interview. One of the things that I just thought was so beautiful is, here's a guy who sold millions of books, made a huge reputation on near-death experience, and you cannot pin him down to say what that means, because he is so skeptically scientific in saying, I will not come to any conclusions. I will not fill in the gaps. I have all these questions that need to be answered. And it seems to me that when we feel a need to rush in and fill the gaps, we're never going to be able to be dislodged from that position. I spoke with a gentleman yesterday, Tom Clark, very, very nice guy, has a website and a new book all about naturalism. So you can imagine, he is on completely on most of these issues, he's on the opposite end that you are at.
Mm-hmm.
But is right. I find that view to be just as dogmatic. I ask him, well, what evidence would it take for you to be open to the possibility and to seriously explore that maybe consciousness does survive death? It's very, very difficult to get folks like that to move and to offer any real opening to say that I really would be open. You know, I think we're almost at that point, or this is what it would take, and have that really mean anything. So I guess I'm just turning that question around to you, not to falsify. I'm not looking to falsify Christianity or to have you, you know, kind of shed your 30 years of belief system that has worked and given your life meaning. I'm just saying, for you as our stand-in Christian here, which we have representing, which you cannot, of course, represent the prototypical Christian. But is there that openness? How do we get to that point where someone can say, you know, I do have to kind of give it pause. I do have to kind of be open to what new discoveries come about.
Well, I think the very existence of the near-death experience itself has opened me up a lot more to a lot of these things. And also the fact that, as was mentioned in some of the studies, we mentioned the von Lommel study from Holland and also the gentleman Peter Fenwick from the UK that spoke at the International Association of Near-Death Studies event, the article I was reading by him summarizing some of the studies. The fact that certain near-death experiences have an element of verifiability where a patient is in the operating room, let's say, and they go into a state of clinical death, come back and report an experience, and they can verify certain things that happened in the operating room that they would not have been able, right, presumably would not have been able to verify otherwise. I mean, that, you know, really gives one a lot of pause to think. And so that has certainly opened my mind a lot to the possibility of the, you know, the human spirit roaming around. And, you know, as the arguments were being made in those two papers, that could be evidence of the survival of consciousness. The difference is, of course, that the people didn't really die. I mean, they were very near death. They came back to death. There's that particular issue. But I think for me, frankly, the thing that would challenge me the most is if someone, a scientist, an historian, an attorney, whatever, could demonstrate to me that the resurrection of Jesus really didn't happen. That would be the biggest thing. And, you know, the historical account is that he was executed, buried, and came back to life, and he was seen by people who later gave their lives because they believed that they'd seen him who'd raised from the dead. Some have said the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is greater than for the existence of other figures of history. And so I realize it's a controversial subject. It does take a while to, you know, get into the evidence. But if someone could, if a scientist could demonstrate to me that the resurrection of Jesus Christ never happened, a lot of things about my life would change. So I think that would be what it would take for me. But I also want to mention something briefly on what you said about the studies showing the consciousness survives. I felt in the two studies that you mentioned to me, the von Lommel study from Holland and also Dr. Fenwick in the UK, that they were overstating their case a bit. And let me just mention, Professor von Lommel, or Dr. von Lommel from Holland, talks about neurophysiology and cardiac arrest, and he's basically talking about these NDEs being experienced during the period of cardiac arrest, and he says all these elements of the NDE were experienced during the period of cardiac arrest, during the period of apparent unconsciousness, during the period of clinical death. And then he says, because of the occasional and verifiable out-of-body experiences, and that's the one that I was referring to where the patient comes back and can talk about different things that they saw and were happening in the operating room. It says, because of those occasional and verifiable OBEs, we know that the NDE must happen during the period of unconsciousness and not in the first or last seconds of this period. Now, I would say verifiability, if that exists, that could show that for that particular account, that particular experience, there's a strong case that it happened during the period of unconsciousness rather than in the fading in or fading out. But I think he's gone too far to say that all of them are like that. But he says, we have to conclude that NDE in our study, as well as in the American and British study, was experienced during a transient functional loss of functions of the cortex and the brainstem. And I think he's gone too far. I think you could say, we have to conclude that in many cases it was, but I think it's going way too far to say that in all the cases.
Perhaps.
You know, I think some of them...
Yeah,
go ahead.
Perhaps. I don't know. I'm not enough of an expert on that particular study or to parse out those words. I would say that what I hear over and over again is that any kind of normal explanation for how the brain would work during that very, very short period of time that it's shutting down after cardiac arrest just doesn't fit with the experience. But I don't know. And I still think the other part of what he's saying, you know, there's been other studies done about that as well, about that resuscitation experience that you're talking about. And Michael Saban is one of the more famous cardiologists who had the case with Pam Reynolds. And then he went on to do further research and found that folks who had the out-of-body near-death experience were much more able to kind of recount the resuscitation than the control group who kind of saw it more like an ER room show that they had seen. So, So I guess you've been very, very open. I think you've really tried to answer all these things very, very completely. I guess we kind of reach an impasse. I just can't go back, and I'm not in no position to argue the resurrection of Jesus, and obviously you find that the most compelling evidence for your case, for your beliefs as a Christian. I wonder where that leaves us as inquirers of science. Would that say that there really anything that we discover or that we find out about consciousness really can't? How does that fit? How does that fit? How does that change your worldview, or does it not?
I would want to be open to the experiences that people communicate. I would also want to look at them with a I don't know if skeptical attitude is the right word, although I am kind of an innate skeptic. I mean, and also as a journalist, I do a fair amount of that. I, you know, want to find out why people say what they're saying and you know, is this true? But I guess I have a bit of skepticism, just like I was talking about the Dutch study and Dr. Fenwick's study. I mean, I think he made the same mistake. I liked very much what he said, but I thought he was going too far in saying that they couldn't, the experiences couldn't be happening during the recovery period. But he had a really delightful little statement. Maybe you remember right at the end of his speech, he says, let me end with a Zen parable. And he refers to a Zen master. It's a Japanese name. I don't know how to pronounce it. Maybe you do. It's H-A-K-U-I-N. I'll say Hakuin just for the sake of argument here. And he says, a nobleman asked Master Hakuin, what happens to the enlightened man at death? Why do you ask me, said Hakim? Well, because you're a Zen master, the man said. And Hakuin said, yes, but not a dead one. And the point he was getting at is that, you know, the Zen master may know a lot, but if he's not dead or hasn't been dead, he can't really say what that was. And that's why I look to Jesus as someone who I believe has died and was more than just a resuscitation after, you know, a few minutes out. It was after several days in the grave. And I think if a person honestly takes a look at evidence, and on the website probe.org, our website, I've got, you know, some articles that talk about that, that's what focused it for me. But I want to be open to what science has to say. I certainly don't want to rule it out. But by the same token, I would raise a question about something that you and Raymond Moody were talking about on that delightful interview about the nature of skepticism. And I think you said, correct me if I'm wrong, that the concept of skepticism, a skeptic was someone who refuses to be pinned down or you know, doesn't want to, won't come to a conclusion. Was that the term the phrase you used?
Right. Basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The concern I have with that, if pushed on that, is that that statement itself is a conclusion. It's a conclusion about the nature of knowing, about the nature of epistemology. To decide that one will not decide is indeed a decision. And so I wrestle with how far I could go with that. I certainly want to ask lots of questions. I want to be inquisitive. I want to question my own faith if necessary. But I would have a hard time adopting a decision that says I'm going to decide not to decide, because that in itself seems to be a decision. So I run into logical problems with that.
Yeah, I'm not very persuaded by the whole... That sounds like a philosophical argument, and I think philosophy is wonderful taken in very small doses. But I think you know what I meant by that, and I think most people know, you know, would know. We know what we're talking about when we say being unable to or unwilling to fill the gaps in knowledge that we have. I mean, when we talk about consciousness, and I'd refer back to the interview I had with Dr. B. Allen Wallace, the very well-respected Buddhist monk, former Buddhist monk, you know, who said, really take an honest look at consciousness. We don't know when it begins. We don't know when it begins at the first trimester, the second trimester. We don't know what's necessary for it. We have artificial intelligence researchers who say they can do it in silicon. We don't know if that's the case. We don't know who has it, who doesn't. We think probably dogs do. We don't know if goldfish does, if goldfish do. So we don't know when it starts. We don't know when it ends, this whole issue of the near-death experience. We don't know what's necessary. We don't know what's sufficient. And yet, we really want to start making a lot of conclusions about it. Well, yeah, we have to kind of go with the best bet that we have, but we have to take a step back and acknowledge there's these gaps. And I understand you feel a need to fill those gaps, and you've found a way to fill those gaps with your belief system, and that's fine. But I look at it objectively and I say, well, there's so much more that we don't know. And the other side, you know, the very hardcore materialist fills those gaps with what I would say some very narrow definitions of what science is. And a lot of times they're taking science that's 100 or 200 years old. But I see more gaps than I see anything else.
Well, I agree. There are lots of unanswered questions, and I appreciate very much what Raymond Moody said, that he doesn't have, how did he say it, he doesn't have all the answers, and you politely tried to, you know, pin him down. I think you said you're being humble, and I'll never know very much, I think is what he said, and you said, oh, you're being humble. And he said, well, I'm being realistic. And I think that's a very healthy attitude to have. I mean, the older I get, the more I learn, the more I realize that I don't know. I think that's very wise. And I also, you know, there are two people that influence me a lot, too, to believe that there's more to life than just the material, that there is the mind. One is Dr. James Coleman, the professor that I had the encounter with there and wrote the term paper and sent it to him. I hesitated to use his name and his story at first without his permission, and so I would ask him, and he'd say several times, he'd say, you know, whatever I've said to you, please feel free to talk to people about using my name, because he said people in our profession, meaning him as a psychologist, need to know that there's more to life than just the material. I mean, he felt very strongly about that. And then the other is Wilder Penfield, the famous Canadian neurosurgeon, who, with all of his years of study in brain science, was convinced that, in fact, he says, in all our studies of the brain, no mechanism has been discovered that can force the mind to think or the individual to believe. This is a statement I have considered and made every effort to disprove without success. And he feels that it's very clear that there's something more than a mechanism, just the mechanical. So I think it's, you know, you're very wise to consider these things. But like I said, for me, it comes back to the resurrection of Christ. If someone could convince me that that didn't happen, I would be forced to look at life and truth through a different grid. But the evidence for that was so overwhelming that it's affected, you know, the entire worldview that I have.
Okay. Hey, Rusty, what's coming up for you in the near future? Any books or speaking engagements you'd like to let people know about in case they want to hear more?
Well, no books. I haven't actually published a book for about 20 years. I've been working on lots of articles, and a lot of my articles are at probe.org, probe.org. And it's interesting that a lot of the work I do now is not so much with the near-death studies, but it's looking at the headlines and trying to discover, sort of, shall we say, moral and ethical lessons in the headlines. And so some of the recent pieces are everything from how Vice President Cheney can use an argument that he's not a member of the executive branch of government, and so he doesn't have to obey executive orders, mm-hmm. to looking at the tragedy at Virginia Tech and, you know, reflection on that and how one copes with grief. Also some things there about starting over, facing the future after significant loss. 11 years ago, during a two-week span in February, my first wife was divorcing me and my employer was firing me and I had a cancer scare. And so things kind of seemed to be falling apart at that point, and here I am 11 years later, happily married, wonderful wife, and a fine job and work and in reasonably good health. So just how do you cope with things like that? That's one of the issues that I've been finding a lot of interest in these days. So,
well, great. I've read a couple of your articles and I've enjoyed them a lot, and I think you do a good job. I also listened to the podcast, the Probe podcast, in preparation for the show, and I found many of the segments thought-provoking, even if not completely persuasive to a belief that's different than mine. I thought that does a good job, not what I would have expected, but then that's more my limitation than and my preconceived notions than anyone else's. Well, we'll definitely link to that those articles on your website, and thanks so much for joining us. It's been a very, very interesting and enlightening dialogue.
Well, likewise, Alex, and I want to say, too, I really appreciate your emphasis on what I would call civil discourse. Sometimes these days, whether it's politics or science or religion or whatever, there's a lot of uncivil discourse, and I really like the emphasis that I've seen on your website and, of course, in talking with you about being able to disagree without being disagreeable. I think there's a need for a lot more of that in society, so I appreciate you fostering that emphasis as well. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words, and look forward to maybe checking in with you sometime in the future.
Great, that would be fun.
Well, thanks again to Rusty for joining us today. If you'd like links to the articles that we mentioned, those will be there in the show notes at skeptico.com. That's www.skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to all our old shows and our archives, and an email address where you can drop me a note or even drop me a voicemail if you like. Not too many people have done that, but feel free. And if it's something noteworthy, I'll definitely add it to the show. Well, that's going to about do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.